Okay, everyone, so let us continue where we left off this morning here. And we just had a look at this very quite profound sutta called, what is it called again? Lumpa Phom, I think it's called. And very profound, but also very beautiful. And sometimes it's just about kind of getting some Buddhist ideas to hear them and to allow them to percolate a bit in your mind, just to get the feeling for what these things are. Some of them are very profound, so if you feel that it's a bit too much, don't be too concerned about that. Just, you know, allow it to be there on the back burner, so to speak, and see what it does to you over time, if it kind of works for you or does not. And this next sutta is also quite profound. It's following on in many ways in a similar kind of vein. And this is from a small extract from the Sabbasava Sutta. And it's about a non-self and about how this idea of a sense of self, how it usually works, and what we can do to overcome that, and how we deal with such issues. And again, it's quite profound, but it's quite interesting. And at least for me, it is interesting. I guess everyone is a bit different. But we'll have a quick look at this, and then we'll move on to more kind of practical ideas, perhaps. But it's all practical, really, because it all belongs together. It's all part and parcel of the same teaching. A bit of theory, a bit of practice, it all kind of comes together in the end. So this is the Sabbasava Sutta, all the taints. And this is how it goes. So this is just a short extract of quite a long sutta. I say that the destruction of the taints is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. Who knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. When one attends unwisely, unarisen taints arise, and arisen taints increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise, and arisen taints are abandoned. So the first thing here, this word taints, is actually the word asava in Pali. And the word asava, the taint, is a very weak translation for the word asava. The asavas are the root corruptions in the mind, the root defilements in the mind that are essentially the kind of almost the final determinant of what decides whether we are going to be stuck in samsara or not. And these asavas are usually three in number: the kama asava, the asava of sensual desire, the corruption, the defilement of sensual desire; the bhava asava, which is the corruption or defilement of being attached to existence. Bhava is existence. And then your avijja-asava, which is the problem, the corruption of ignorance or of delusion itself. These are the usual three asavas, and they are kind of often used as a final analysis of what drives us on in samsara, what attaches us in samsara. One way of translating the word asava is as outflowing, because it makes the mind flow out into the world, flows out into existence, carries on, projects itself into the future, attaches to the world, and so on, drives this process called samsara. That is what the asavas do in the kind of the deepest sense. But in this sutta, it is also used slightly differently. Here, the word asava actually is used a bit more broadly to refer to any kind of defilements of the mind. So occasionally, words have slightly different meanings depending on the context. So here, it is used in a slightly different way. So he starts off by saying that the destruction of these corruptions of the mind is for one who knows and sees. In other words, you have to have insight. Passati and jhanati, to know and to see. So you have to have direct insight into things. You have to know how things work. That is how you attain these things. And a person who knows and sees, of course, is primarily, first of all, it is the stream enterer. The stream enterer knows and sees. And then, having known and seen through stream entry, then you carry on the process until you become an arahant. And that's when you have the destruction of the asavas. Can you hear okay despite the rain? Is it all right? Yeah, you can hear. Okay, good. Excellent. Please let me know if there is any problem like that. So that is the starting point, destruction of the asavas. And what is it that is required? Who knows and sees what? And to know, who knows and sees wise attention and unwise attention. This is yoniso manasikara and ayoniso manasikara, two very important words or phrases in the Pali Suttas. And It's only when you become a stream mentor. When you become a stream mentor, you actually have full yonisomanasikara, full ayonisomanasikara. You know fully how to attend in the right way and how to avoid attending in the wrong way. Why? Because you know what is wholesome, you know what is unwholesome, you know where the defilements are, you know what the purity of the mind are. You have seen the Four Noble Truths, so you know the nature of the path, yeah? All of this has become clear to you because that's part of the insight into the Four Noble Truths. So only then, only at that point, do you have yoniso manasikara. In other words, it is established in you. And before that, one of the things that we are all striving for on the path is to attain as much yoniso manasikara as we possibly can and to get rid of the ayoniso manasikara. We want to reflect wisely, yeah, as much as we can, not unwisely. This is what the whole practice is about. You want to know where your defilements lie. You want to know how to speak in the right way. Am I coming from defilements or not? What is driving this speech right now? Is it, am I being egocentric or am I being kind of altruistic towards the world around me? And sometimes it's very hard to tell. Sometimes the defilements are so subtle, you don't really know exactly where you're coming from. So this idea of uncovering the deeper layers of the mind, uncovering the problems, understanding what is wholesome and unwholesome, this is very much a part, very important part of this path. And this is why, reflection on your meditation after you meditate, it is so important. Looking at your mind, knowing yourself, knowing where your problems are, uncovering it layer by layer by layer, so you can actually go deeper and deeper and eventually see through this all together. And this is why this word yoniso manasikara is so important, because every time you have yoniso manasikara, you are heading in the right direction. Every time you have ayoniso manasikara, unwise attention, you're going in the wrong direction. You're increasing the defilements, increasing your binding to samsara. You're kind of adding a bit of glue to samsara, yeah, and you can't really get off anymore. So yoniso manasikara goes back to the very beginning of the path. When you start out, the first time you hear about the Buddhist teachings, and you think, yeah, this is it. I finally found something useful in my life. Until now, I've been struggling. I've been trying to kind of find some principles to live by. I haven't really found anything useful. And then you hear it. And that is kind of the first time you really have yoniso manasikara, because your mind is leaning in the right direction. You have understood what is wholesome and what is not. And then you keep on. Every time you have yoniso manasikara on this path, you are moving in the right direction. You see, okay, I've got to leave this behind. I've got to develop these things. Develop some more calm and peace. Yeah, you get that. So you do that. And you, not only do you do it, you know how to direct your mind to achieve these things. And so you direct your mind accordingly. That is the real yoniso manasikara. Every time you direct the mind in the right direction. So this is a struggle because we are deluded. We don't even know when we have yoniso manasikara, when we haven't. And this is part of the problem. This only really arises when you become a stream mentor. Then you know. Yeah, you have no doubt anymore. Okay. So, and then this is precisely the definition. Yeah, when you attend unwisely, unarisen defilements arise and arisen defilements increase. And when you attend wisely, the unarisen defilements do not arise, and arisen defilements are abandoned. This is the definition, if you like, one of the few definitions in the suttas of wise attention. You find it right here in this sutta. So the definition is simply, if you, practice today and you find that at the end of the day you have a bit more clarity than you had at the beginning of the day, or after the meditation you have more clarity, you have a bit more kindness in your heart, a bit more compassion, you have a bit more whatever it is, peace, all of these wholesome things, a bit more insight, yeah, then you have had yoniso manasikara at least in part through the day. Yeah? If at the end of the day you feel more kind of negative, it's not going anywhere, I just feel confused, I don't understand. What is he talking about, that monk up there? I don't understand what he's talking about. Yeah? If that is what happens, then at the end of the day, then it's ayoniso manasikara, yeah? And you kind of feel a little bit down because things aren't going right or whatever. Yeah? So this is basically what it means. That is how you know. So if you feel, after the meditation, you feel more clarity, you know that you've had yoniso manasikara. So look back at that process. Try to understand how you had yoniso manasikara. What were you attending to? How were you reflecting? How were you using your mind to achieve more calm and peace? And you will see that there are certain things that work. Yeah, when you think in certain ways, it leads to calm. When you think in other ways, it leads to trouble. When you have a positive approach, when you appreciate your being here, when you prioritize the spiritual path, all of these things, you can see, you learn how to do that in your own way, because these things are quite personal. So learn how to do it your own way. And when you learn that, these things become like a treasury inside of you that you can use to apply and then make the path grow also in the future. All about this is to build up an understanding of how the mind works, yeah? And then you can apply these things in the future to help your meditation practice and whatever. Okay. So that is just very briefly about yoniso and ayoniso manasikara. And then the Buddha goes on to say that there are a large number of corruptions of the mind. There are seven ways of dealing with the corruptions, of abandoning these corruptions. And one of these ways is called the abandonment by seeing. This is the first one in this sutta. And this is the one I want to have a look at, because it relates directly to the idea of right view, which is what we're still doing here. So this is what he says. What taints should be abandoned, or what corruptions should be abandoned by seeing? Here, the untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and untrained in their teaching, who has no regard for superior people and is unskilled and untrained in their teaching, does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since this is so, they attend to those things unfit for attention, and they do not attend to those things fit for attention. Yeah, so here the Buddha is saying, untaught ordinary person, the asuttava putujana is the untaught ordinary person. So this is the untaught means you haven't heard any good teachings, yeah, you haven't heard any Dhamma teachings, and you are ordinary means that you are not a noble person, you're not an Arya. And you have no regard for those people. In other words, you just dismiss them. Yeah, those shaven-headed ascetics, you know, who wants to know what they have to say? And you kind of walk off on the wrong path. That's what that is sometimes seen in the suttas. You have this kind of fellow early on. Actually, I took that out of the Majjhima 26. It's a nice little story in the Majjhima 26, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search, where the Buddha, on his way, after his awakening, he meets this fellow on his way to Varanasi. He's walking to Varanasi to meet the five disciples. And on this way, he meets this Ajivika disciple. Ajivikas, they were a certain sect of ascetics or a certain religion at that time. And he meets this Ajivika disciple. And this Ajivika disciple looks at the Buddha. Yeah? And he says to the Buddha, you look pretty bright. What happened to you? Yeah? What's going on? Why do you look so bright? And then the Buddha comes out with this beautiful verse about, you know, how the house builder has been... I can't remember. So it's a very beautiful verse about it being the conqueror who has conquered all and all this. And then this Ajivika disciple, he kind of just shakes his head, yeah, and he kind of walks off the wrong way afterwards. And it's interesting, yeah, it's so interesting, because here you are in the presence of the number one spiritual genius in the history of humanity, someone who has just broken through, someone who's radiating wisdom and everything, and you are in the presence of the person, and you just don't recognize it. You can't see it. You're completely blind. And then the metaphor is that he walks off on a bypath, umaga. Umaga means like the wrong path. Yeah, literally. So he just walks off and he kind of disappears into the big bad world of samsara again. He was so close. And the question for myself is always, well, you know, people say, okay, you know, we just wait, we just chill until Maitreya comes. Yeah, just relax, Maitreya will come around soon, just wait for that. But if Maitreya comes, probably I will just be like this Ajivika disciple. I will meet the Buddha, say, yeah, whatever, and I will walk off the wrong path, yeah? And this is the problem. We just don't know what's going to happen, because we haven't got that wisdom often to actually recognize these things. So please don't wait for Maitreya. Please, now is the time to do these things. Yeah, now is the opportunity. Yeah? Because things are so impermanent and unreliable. Yeah? So anyway, this is the untaught ordinary person. Yeah? And also the same thing, untrained in true men, it says here, this true men is the saparesa. Saparesa, again, being the Aryas, the noble ones. And because you're untrained in all of that, you have no idea what is fit for attention and what is unfit for attention. This goes straight back to what we were saying before, yeah, the yoniso and ayoniso manasikara. And this ties in with the sutta I did here last year, for those of you who were last year, during my retreat last year. It's a nice little sutta in the Anguttara Tens, number 61, which is called Avijja. It's a very nice sutta. I would really recommend you to have a look at that one. And if you can't grasp it fully, that sutta, because it's quite involved, I have done that one at Dhammaloka Center, so you can listen to the recording of that if you wish. And a very beautiful sutta, which starts off by saying that, first of all, saparisa or kalyanamitta, I can't remember which word is it. Anyway, you meet someone who is like a noble one, yeah, at the beginning. Then you hear the Dhamma. When you hear the Dhamma, you gain faith. And from that faith comes the yoniso manasikara. Because the Buddha, initially, yoniso manasikara, the wise attention, is not ours. We haven't got it yet. So initially, the Buddha tells us, well, this is how you attend. And you think, yeah, this makes sense. And so you follow the way the Buddha prescribes how to attend to things, how to think about things, how to perceive, how to reflect, and all of that. So it comes out of faith, which is interesting. Yeah, initially, wisdom, wise attention, comes from faith, which is quite slightly counterintuitive. We think of these things as slightly different, but the wisdom initially comes from faith. And then you develop that wisdom, and as you do so, gradually it becomes your own, until eventually you become a stream mentor. Then it is fully your own wisdom, and you know what these things are. Wise attention, unwise attention. So because you haven't got a clue, yeah, because you don't know what's going on, you attend to those things unfit for attention, and you do not attend to those things that are fit for attention, the Buddha says here. So what does this mean in practice? And the Buddha says, what are the things unfit for attention that he attends to? And this goes on for quite a while, and it's quite interesting the way this is expressed here. There are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen corruption of sensual desire arises in him, and the arisen corruption of sensual desire increases. The unarisen corruption of desire for existence, of being, it says here, arises in him, and the arisen corruption of desire for being increases. And the unarisen corruption of avidya, yeah, arise in him, and the arisen corruption of avidya increases. So this is how you decide, yeah, whether you are attending wisely or not. In other words, if negative states arise in you, if they are becoming more, it means you are attending unwisely. So unarisen taint or unarisen corruption of sensual desire arises, and if it has arisen, it increases. How does this happen? And again, it's very simple, it's very easy. If you watch your mind a little bit, it's very easy to see how sensual desire arises. Yeah, you see some nice food. Yeah, see some nice food, and perhaps you are a little bit hungry, and you didn't actually think about food beforehand. But because as soon as you see it, bang, you are caught. Yeah, it's like a hook, hooks into your mind, and now the desire for that food has arisen. It's as simple as that. It is how you look at things. If you see that food as attractive, as something that you would like, then sensual desire arises as a consequence. And that is true for all the five senses. It is true for relationships we have, true for all of that. You see something as attractive, then the desire arises as a consequence. So the trick is to learn to see these things as not so attractive, to remember the downside of these things. When you remember the downside, that is where you give up that sensual desire. This is what is meant by wise attention, understanding the downside, the limitations of these things. Yeah, so you remember that. This is not so easy to do, because sensual desires tend to be so attractive to us, tend to be so enjoyable. This is what people often live for, yeah, to enjoy themselves and all these kind of things. But it's actually quite hard to do. And this is one of the reasons why a little bit of meditation already shows you the way, the path forward, because you start to see that actually the happiness of meditation can be, sometimes it is, depending on how deep you go, far superior to the sensual world. Yeah, the sensual world always involved with craving. Yeah. Craving itself is an irritation and a problem. You're never where you want to be. Always a distance between where you are and where you want to be. Yeah, if you look at that, you start to see it's a feeling of dissatisfaction, never being content, which is very, very different from meditation when it starts to work out. So this is how you gradually uncover this problem. Yeah, and how you start to find alternative routes to kind of guide yourself around the sensual pleasures of the world. But again, as I said yesterday, I would usually recommend people to focus on ill will much more than sensuality, because ill will is by far the worst problem and also easier to deal with. But I will talk more about sensual pleasures later on, just to give you some guidance on how, at least how to think about these things. The arisen taint of being, of existence. Yeah, so this is a kind of just enjoying the feeling of existence. As I mentioned before today, the sense of doing, yeah? We take ourselves to be the doers, and we get off on doing simply because we identify with the doer. So this is like that. We do lots of stuff, and we do more and more just to gratify the feeling of doing inside, so we can kind of exist in that sense, yeah? Or the ego, we want to build up the ego because the ego kind of, you know, demands gratification as well. We want to become more this or that. We want to become more powerful or whatever it is, yeah? Because the ego desires power. That's kind of one of the functions of the ego, to desire power, because when you have power, you can control more. The ego wants to control because then you have a larger playing area where you can kind of enjoy yourself and all of that sort of stuff. This is what the ego does. When you go inside of yourself, you're letting go of the external world. You're actually controlling also less and less. This is part of the path of meditation practice. This is the taint of being. Yeah, the desire to kind of build up that ego and all of these kind of things. And of course, ultimately, just to exist itself. You want to exist. Why do we want to exist? Because we already feel we exist. And if we don't exist, our sense of identity is threatened. And that's why we desire to exist in the first place. If somebody comes and says, I'm going to kill you, yeah, you don't say, yeah, whatever, yeah, please kill me. You say, no, go away, I'm not ready to die. Yeah, that's because you have a desire for existence still. And then the last one is the taint of delusion. Yeah, the taint of delusion arises. How do we know about the taint of delusion arising and increasing? And this is another, the same sutta I was just talking about before, the one where you have, first of all, you meet the superior people, the Aryans. From meeting them, then you have the hearing the good Dhamma, you have faith, and then you have Yoniso Manasikara. The same sutta also explains the things that cause delusion in the mind, cause avidya. And the sutta says the thing that causes avidya is, or not really causes it in the final sense, but kind of increases it and keeps it going up and down depending how strong they are, is the five hindrances. The five hindrances are the things that are the nutriment, it says in that sutta, the ahara for avidya, for delusion. So simply by reducing the five hindrances, and that's such an important part of the path, yeah, we do that all the time, just by being kind, just by thinking in the right way, just by being peaceful in meditation practice, we are actually reducing the five hindrances. So hopefully you will see yourself emerging from delusion a little bit. Yeah, do you know what I mean by emerging from delusion? It means that, you know, some days you feel perhaps more clarity. You feel more sense of your mind is kind of calm and easy, and you look around and you have a clarity about what is going around you. Other days you feel completely confused. Yeah, you don't know up from down or backwards from forwards. It's just completely all over the place. Yeah, I'm sure you know exactly what I mean, right? Because the mind is always changing like this. So that is where you already have less delusion. If you are developing a mind that has more clarity in this way, you're already moving towards reducing delusion and ignorance right there. This is how you can know inside of yourself whether you are deluded or not, and whether it's getting better or worse. It's quite simple, really. It doesn't mean that you have uncovered delusion fully. You haven't, because that's a long way down the line, but you're kind of heading in that direction. So that is a rough idea of the three root asavas, and how to kind of have some idea how they arise, what unwise and wise attention is in regard to these three asavas. But that wasn't really the thing I wanted to talk the most about. That comes up sooner. So, and then he says, what are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen corruption of sensual desire does not arise in them, and the arisen corruption of sensual desire is abandoned. Yeah, the unarisen corruption of desire for existence does not arise in them, and the arisen corruption of desire for existence is abandoned. The unarisen corruption of delusion does not arise in them, and the arisen corruption of delusion is abandoned. Yeah, so you reduce the hindrances, and then gradually these corruptions are abandoned as a consequence. This is the yoniso manasikara. These are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to. By attending to things unfit for attention and by not attending to things fit for attention, both unarisen corruptions arise in him and arisen corruptions increase. So that is the basic outline. And now we come to a very specific way of looking at this. And this is really the reason why I wanted to have a look at this sutta, but also all of this information about wise attention is also quite interesting, I thought, so I let it be in there. But now we come to a specific instance of unwise attention. And this is how the Buddha talks about this. He says, this is how one attends unwisely. Yeah, this is how you have ayoniso manasikara. And it goes like this. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? Yeah, so this is you know, all to do with this sense of self, yeah, sense of identity. Who are we? What you were in the past, and thinking about this and philosophizing about it, trying to figure out exactly what is the real you, what is the essence of what you are. And all of these things, says the Buddha, because they are based on the idea of I, yeah, based on the idea that you exist, that's kind of the underlying idea there, these are all unwise attention. It's interesting, isn't it? All of this stuff is unwise attention. Every time you think about yourself and what you are and whatever, it's actually unwise. So the idea to meditate on the idea of who am I, the Buddha says it's wrong way of meditating. You should never meditate on the idea of who am I, because you're already asking the wrong question. So never think that that is a good way to meditate. Sometimes I hear people say that, and I think, that's not the right way to do meditation practice. Who am I? That's the wrong way to think about things. And Ajahn Brahm once pointed out a very nice way of meditating. If you want to reflect in that way, you should ask yourself, instead of asking, who am I? You should ask yourself, what do I take myself to be? That is the right way of thinking here. If you ask, who am I? You are already assuming a sense of self there. But if you ask, who do I take myself to be? Then you're asking, looking at those areas inside of you that you grasp as a self, and then looking whether they really are worthy of being grasped as a self. It's a very different approach. Yeah, one, you are uncovering any delusion you may have. The other one, you are reinforcing that delusion. So what do I take myself to be is a better thing. There is a nice sutta in the Sangyutta Nikaya. There's many nice suttas in the Sangyutta, but there's particularly one that I want to talk about. And there, the Buddha says very nicely, he talks about some very similar to this in many ways. And he starts off with the idea, I am. Yeah, and he says the idea, I am, one of the most simplest ideas you can think of, yeah, I am, is, he calls it a papancha. Papancha means like a proliferation. It means a thinking about things in the wrong way, just mind going on, thinking about stuff which doesn't really exist. He calls it a manyita. Manyita is another way of misconception. Yeah. And he has all these beautiful words that show how the very idea of I am is a misunderstanding. And you can see all of these things that are mentioned here, they are based on the idea of I am. If you think I am, you've already gone too far. You've already missed the boat. You've already gone the wrong direction. You already have wrong view. It's already ayonisomanasikara, yeah? It's very easy to get ayonisomanasikara. All you have to do is think I am, and already you are in trouble. So what does this mean? You know, it's almost impossible not to think I am. It's almost it's asking too much of people not to think like this. So what it really means, it doesn't mean that from now on, every time you think I am or where do I come from or what am I or whatever, it's kind of evil or anything like that. That's not really what it means. What it means is just to open up another horizon, open up another possibility that maybe these ideas that we have that are so close to us, I am, where have I been, where am I going, this ego, things that kind of revolve around the ego about who we are, etc., to question that. Is it really true? Yeah, open up a new perspective on these things. Don't think you're going to overcome this easily. This only is only overcome through deep insight. But the very fact that you're open to an alternative view, another way of looking at things, already opens up the possibility that down the line you will be able to overcome this. If you never question these thoughts, if you take them for granted, it means you are stuck in wrong view. You're stuck in a misconceived way of looking at reality. And if you are stuck in that, you can't get out of it. So first of all, you have to question the validity of these things, and then you have a possibility of emerging from these things. How do we do this in practice? And in practice, it's actually very simple again. It comes back to the things that I've been talking about the last couple of days. In your meditation, you start to see how the self, you know, becomes less and less. There's less and less of the five khandhas in there. Everything becomes simpler and simpler. And there's less and less areas that the self can exist. You're giving up the body. You're giving up the senses. You're giving up so much. And those things you have given up, well, the self can't be there. Yeah. So you're kind of reducing the area where the self can possibly be until one day you see the impermanence of everything. And that's where everything gets given up. So watch that. Watch that, what happens in meditation. Yeah, first of all, it's delightful. It's really happy to give up the sense of self. You feel better as you do so. But also, it gives you this insight into those areas that cannot be a self. Why? Because they disappear. And when they disappear, well, you are still there. But those things, obviously, were not essential to you. If they had been essential to you, they couldn't have disappeared in the first place. So this is how we do it. Yeah, there's nothing particularly fancy about it. It's fairly kind of straightforward. This is the problem with these kind of slightly more philosophical approaches to the Dhamma. It's easy to be lost in the philosophy without really understanding how to apply it properly. So then the Buddha goes on. When he attends unwisely in this way, one of six views arise in him. The view self exists for me, arise in him as true and established. Or the view no self exists for me, arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with self, arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive not self or non-self with self, arises in him as true and established, or not self. Or the view I perceive self with not self, arises in him as true and established. Or else he has some such view as this. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. This speculative view is called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. So let's just stop there let's just stop there for a second here. So what are all of these things? So, you know, starting out from the idea of I am, humanity constructs all kind of theories of self. Yeah, philosophy is about the self. That's what the Brahmanical teachings are about the releasing of the self and unifying with Brahma. That is what the Christian idea of a soul really is. It's an idea about a self inside of us. And most religions and even philosophies have some such ideas. And this is what this points to. It points to some of these philosophies that is possible to develop about the idea of a self. So, what are these six views? The first one is the self exists for me, arises him as true and established. Yeah, this is quite a common view. Yeah, almost all religions of the world have that kind of view. The idea that when you die, you carry on afterwards. Yeah, Christianity has that view, Hinduism has that view. It's found almost everywhere in religions. Very, very common. Yeah, and it is, from a Buddhist point of view, it is driven from the desire to exist and from the perception that there is a true self inside of us. That is the foundation upon which these views are built. And then there is the other view, no self exists for me. Yeah, this particular view is not the same as the Buddhist insight. This particular view refers to the idea that when you die, you pass away, everything is just finished. Yeah, the kind of modern atheist view of the world or the modern materialist view of the world, that when you die, everything is gone, everything is finished, blank, okay, existence is over. That is that particular view, and also a very common view in the world. And surprisingly, a view which goes back all the way back to the time of the Buddha. There were materialists back then who had this kind of view already established. So it's not often we think, you know, that, wow, we are so sophisticated, we have all this kind of view, but actually humanity has always been quite sophisticated in terms of philosophy and views, and I suspect that these particular views have existed as long as humanity has been around. So these are the two basic views, yeah? And then you have some more, a bit more complex views, or views that kind of arise out of those basic ones. The view, I perceive self with self, arises in him as true and established. What does this mean? And it means that you have the five khandhas, yeah? And then you identify one part of those khandhas as the self. For example, let's say you take the knowing to be the self, yeah? The fact that I know things, I'm aware of things, that is myself. You take that as yourself, which is very common. Yeah? Almost everyone does that. And then you have this ability to know your own knowing. It's called the reflexive knowledge. You know your own knowing. You know that you know, and you know that this is myself. Yeah. So the self knows itself. That's what this is saying. So I know, I can be aware of the fact that I know. Yeah. And that knowing, I take that to be myself. That's really all it means. The self perceives the self. Yeah. You have a self-reflection about what is going on, reflexive awareness of the consciousness. Don't worry too much about this. If it doesn't make sense to you, don't worry too much, because it doesn't really matter all that much. These are just the kind of fancy way of dividing up different views about the self, really. The view, I perceive not self with self. Yeah, this is the idea that you have a self, and that self is maybe a little bit hidden to you. You don't know exactly what it is, but you see all these other aspects of personality. Yeah, you see the will, for example. Okay, the will, that is not, you don't, or take, let's take the body instead. Yeah, you perceive the body. You know the body is not yourself, but your inner feelings or your inner awareness, that is myself. And I see the body through this inner awareness. The inner awareness is myself, the body is not. That's all that means, really. And then the last one, I perceive self with not self. So this is the sense that this would be, for example, you take the doing to be yourself, and then the awareness is aware of the doing. The awareness is not self, but the doing is self. So the point here is simply that this is a person, yeah, five khandhas, and of these five khandhas, some of those khandhas are self and some are not self, yeah? So sometimes the self part of the khandha sees the non-self part of the khandha, or the non-self part of the khandha sees the self part of the khandha, or something like that. It's just a way of dividing up the five khandhas into various ways. Now, one of the What is interesting here, one of the things that if you have been extremely sharp, now you get A plus in the Buddhism if you get this one, yeah? This is one of the things that is missing here. The one thing that's missing is I perceive non-self with non-self. Yeah, all the other three variations of self and non-self is there. Perceiving self with self, perceiving non-self with self, perceiving self with non-self. The one that is missing is I perceive non-self with non-self. That is not there. Why? Because that is the Buddhist attitude. That is the right one. Yeah? So that is why it is missing there. This is what we do when you are observing yourself in meditation or whatever. What is going on? You are using your five khandhas that are non-self to observe your five khandhas that are also non-self. Yeah? Do you agree? That makes sense, yeah? So you are taking your five khandhas, they are right here, and then you're observing the five khandhas, using those five khandhas. That is actually correct. That is the Buddhist idea of what is going on. But of course, to be able to see that, you have to have these profound insights. As long as you believe, as long as you have a sense of self, you're not going to be able to appreciate that. But that is actually the right attitude. Okay, and then we have this final one, the final view. It is this self of mind that speaks, feels, and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. This self of mind is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. Yeah, what does this mean? It's a kind of a very... quite a complex idea of self, where you take most of the five khandhas to be yourself. Yeah, the one that speaks, that's the doer, that's the sankhara khanda. The one that feels is the vedana khanda. Experiences here could be just the consciousness khanda. Yeah, so you're taking these five khandhas, especially the four mental khandhas, and you're saying, yeah, that's the me, yeah? And in the future, I will experience the results of bad actions. That's the permanent self which will experience that. And this is permanent, everlasting, yeah? It is like a pillar, yeah? That would never kind of be shaken by earthquakes or winds or anything like that. That's basically how it is explained elsewhere in the suttas. And that is how you get the eternalist view about things kind of going on for eternity, which is so common in the world. But in Buddhism, all of these views that we have looked at now, all of this, they are called speculative views. Why are they speculative? They are speculative because there is no reality that they refer to. There is nothing apart. It's just a view, but it doesn't actually refer to anything that exists. That is why it is speculative, yeah? And that's why the Buddha calls it a thicket of views. You are lost. You're in the bush. You're in the jungle fighting your way out, but you have wrong view. So you're kind of stuck in that thicket of views. The wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. You are bound to samsara because you have wrong view. Your sense of self is the most fundamental thing that binds you to existence. It fetters you to reality. It's kind of scary, isn't it? This sense of self that is so dear to us. I am. I want to exist. Please don't kill me. I want to kind of keep on living. I don't want to die. I'm not ready to die. All of this. That thing which is so dear to us turns out to be the thing that in the end actually tortures us. Ties us to samsara and actually is the ultimate thing that we have to overcome if we want to find any real happiness in life. So this is why this view is so important. And again, it is not about the fact that you have to take on board any view kind of absolutely because it really is impossible. The most important thing is that you're open to the possibility that this is true. If you're open to that, it means that when you do your meditation practice, you will be able to understand your experience in the right way instead of just being trapped by the old habits and the old perceptions. Okay. So, then the Buddha says, fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person is not freed from birth, old age, death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He is not freed from suffering, I say. So that is the problem with wrong view. And now we have the other side of the equation. The well-taught, noble disciple who has regard... What is the Pali word there? I can't remember now. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Who has regard for the noble ones and is skilled and trained in their Dhamma. Who has regard for superior people and is skilled and trained in the Dhamma. Understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, they do not attend to those things unfit for attention, and they attend to those things fit for attention. Yeah, so this is the idea of kind of getting going in the Dhamma. What are the things unfit for attention that they do not attend to? They are things such that when they attend to them, the unarisen corruption of sensual desire, the unarisen desire does not arise in him. Is that right? Does not arise in him. I'm not sure what's happened there. And the arisen taint of ignorance. No, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. Increases. These are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to. And what are the things fit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen corruption of sensual desire does not arise in him, etc., etc., and the arisen corruption of delusion is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention that he attends to by not attending to things unfit for attention, and by attending to things fit for attention, unarisen corruptions do not arise in him, and the arisen corruptions are abandoned. So then the Buddha goes on. So this is just the opposite of what we had before. And this is how you attend wisely. Yeah, nothing very surprising in this. How do you attend wisely? You attend. This is suffering. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him. Personality view, sakkaya ditti, doubt, vichikicca, adherence to precepts and observances, sila, bhatta, paramasa. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So this is how you attend wisely. And you may wonder, how is this the opposite of what we have just been talking about? We've just been talking about the sense of self, how we should not build up theories of what we are and of existence and of eternalism and all of these kind of things. Exactly how do these things relate together? And the way they relate together is that when you attend to this is suffering, this again, you do this in your meditation practice, you see things disappearing that have always been there, and you think, wow, how nice it is to get rid of those things. And then you understand where suffering lies. And when you understand where suffering lies, you also understand where non-self is. Because those things that are suffering, they are not self. If something is impermanent, if something is suffering, it is not self by definition, because by definition a self is something which is always there and is something which is happy. So by attending in this way, you are counteracting all this tendency to exist, to be, and your ego gradually decreases. This is what you find in meditation. You become less and less concerned with the outer world, with controlling things, and the sense of who you are starts to diminish, and it gets kind of concentrated into this very little area. And actually, it's so nice when that happens. You're getting rid of suffering, getting rid of all these other things. And because you have an open mind about the sense of self, you are able to discard things that are suffering on the way. You don't hold on to them. When the point comes to discard the very will, this thing which is so dear to us and so close to us, you're able to do so because you have an open mind about even the will, whether that is you or is not you. So you're able to discard the will itself. And then you see, wow, the will too is non-self. And so you keep going all the way down the line until everything is gone. The five khandhas are completely abandoned. And you understand suffering fully. So these things are very closely related to each other. And you attend wisely. This is the origin of suffering. You see In the end, you understand the craving is the source that drives these things on. Yeah, you're no longer interested in all these five khandhas, so you want to stop this whole thing. You understand the cessation of this whole thing here, the elimination of that very same craving here. And as you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, gradually that Noble Eightfold Path becomes clear to you. Yeah, it's a gradual clarification as you practice it. You understand how you abandon all of these negative things, how you get rid of them, and how then gradually you move on until eventually you practice the whole path. And then as you do that, these three fetters are abandoned in you. Yeah, personality view, sakkaya ditti, is abandoned. This is precisely the view that there is a self in the five khandhas, that there's something there which is inherent, which is essential, which is the eternal you, which is always there. That is completely abandoned when you become a stream enterer. So stream enterer has perfect view, ditti patto, attained to view, seeing things according to reality. That is the very first fetter that is abandoned. And this is why, once you become a stream mentor, that is why we have the word stream mentor in the first place. Yeah, you have entered the stream of the Dhamma because you have seen reality. You know, there's nothing here to hold on to anymore. And then it is like an automatic process that unravels itself. The perceptions, the views, the thinking, everything gradually falls into line until eventually you become an arahant down the line. This is why this is such an important insight, the sakkaya ditti. Sakkaya means something like the existing body, yeah, or the existing personality. The word kaya in this context does not mean body, it actually means like person, the existing person. Yeah, you have the idea of an existing person has been given up, that view, sakkaya ditti, is abandoned. You no longer have a sense of existing in any real way, in any permanent, essential way. And that is what is happening there. That is why it's called sakkaya ditti. Doubt has been given up, yeah, because you have seen the Dhamma for yourself. No grounds for doubt anymore. You know what you have to do. You know what you should not be doing. And you kind of, whoa, vichikicca, the last of the five hindrances, is abandoned once and for all. No more adherence to precepts and observances. Why is that? Because now the stream mentor is someone who has taken on board morality. You have become a moral person. It's part of who you are. You can't really be bad anymore. If you do some bad things by mistake, then you tend to admit it and confess it straight away. That's one of the characteristics of the stream mentor. And very good. Yeah, one of the things that you abandon at this point, you abandon the kind of the being the dog duty ascetic and the ox duty ascetic of the Kukravatika Sutta. So you no longer have to walk around on all fours and pretend to be a dog or to pretend to be an ox. Yeah, you've given that up because you know that's not the path to awakening. Yeah, you can kind of got rid of that one. So, and it's strange, isn't it? Because people think that these things, that it's weird how we kind of construct these ideas about what is the path to awakening here. Yeah, and this is, it's a very interesting case in the suttas, this dog duty ascetic in Majjhima Nikaya 57, I think it is, where this sutta is, the Kukuravattika Sutta, the dog duty ascetic. So interesting, people get into this idea that if you live like a dog, you're going to become awakened or you're going to go to heaven or whatever, yeah? So they live like a dog. It's weird, but this is how the mind works. So it's good to kind of be on the lookout for that. So you kind of give up. You will never again will you be a dog duty ascetic until the end of samsara. And thank goodness, because that's not really a very nice way to live. What is interesting, people who travel to India, I didn't see that when I was there, but they tell you that you go to India, you still see people practicing these kind of things, yeah? Because India is this amazing country which is so religious in many ways. This kind of vast conglomerations of various ideas about religion. You see all kind of stuff in India. I must admit, I love India because it's so diverse and all of these things that you see there. And you can see how that... So occasionally enlightened beings will come out of that, yeah, because everyone is trying, some very foolishly, but some very wisely. Yeah. And still, go to India, you can still see this dog duty ascetics, yeah, people crawling around on all four, trying to practice a spiritual life. And very, very fascinating here. Anyway, so that is then gone. And so these are the three fetters that are abandoned in you. And when they are abandoned in you, you become a stream enterer. That is the very definition of stream entry here. So again, these things are not to be taken so much as what you have to do. Yeah, these are not prescriptions for how to practice. These are results of the practice. So don't be too concerned if you have a little bit of Sakkaya Ditti. You're going to have that regardless. Just remember to have the openness of mind that allows you to challenge these ideas. That is what is important. Don't be afraid if you cling on and attach a little bit to your precepts. That's good. Just know that when you become a stream enterer, then that clinging, then that attachment will be abandoned automatically all by itself. Okay, so that sutta took a lot longer than I had expected. I was sort of thinking 10 minutes, you know, but that was an hour gone already. Once you get into these things, it's quite interesting. I hope you enjoy these kind of things. If you don't, it is okay. Yeah, I don't expect everyone to enjoy everything on this retreat. Please don't feel obliged to enjoy things. These are some of the most theoretical things I will look at. From now on, we're going to be looking at much more practical things and things that are easier to relate to. But it's always interesting, I think, to look at this idea of right view in a bit of detail, because it is the foundation of the path. Get these things right, and you really kickstart the process of practice. It's because it kind of pushes you in the right direction. And for that reason, I'm going to spend at least one or two more sessions tomorrow to look at right view before we really start looking at the practice tomorrow. But there will be more practical aspects of right view, not quite as theoretical as these ones. Anyway, that is all for now, and we'll see you again this evening at 7:30.